WBRU changes to Radio Christian Providence, bringing college insulation to the real world, a small excuse to put us all away, and useful slang from the year of my birth. I'm Justin Katz, and this is Last Impressions, episode 29. Now, I've had a few, I guess you'd call them long-form podcasts over the past few weeks. So with this one, I wanted to maybe bring it to back to a kind of a quick-hit format. I don't know if I'm going to be able to do it. Sometimes, you know, the topics just cause you to ramble. It's not your own fault, you know, it happens. So unless I can't help myself, though, that's what I'm going to try to do. A few years back, with the loss of my mother and then a few years later, my grandfather, I had occasion to be moving my father and my grandmother up to Rhode Island from New Jersey. And for that purpose, I found a good mover. We used the same movers both times, Mahwah movers, after Mahwah is a town in New Jersey. So if you're ever making that same trip, one way or the other, I suppose, I'd recommend them. Now, on the first one, we were picking up my father. We were talking to some of the guys, and they went to actually the high school at which my father used to teach. And it's Eastside High in Paterson, New Jersey, which if you may know, or you probably don't, but that's the high school that was featured in the movie Lean on Me, in which the hard-hitting, high-integrity principal comes in and almost literally beats the students into good order, kicks out the drug dealers and their fights in the halls. He breaks them up. And that was the high school my father taught at. Now, by the time my father got there, it was a number of years past that peak. But there were some times, you know, it's a rough neighborhood, rough school. And there were some times it was actually a pretty good thing. My dad was a pretty big guy because he had to grapple with a kid literally once, he didn't initiate anything, but the kid tried to take him down or something like that. So as the movers were loading up my father's stuff, it turned out that, you know, they had gone to that high school, some of them. And, you know, I offer that as kind of the description of what the sort of demographic that was there. Now, I'm not talking racial demographics, although it was a mixed crew, just, you know, guys who from a relatively rough city who didn't really, you know, have much, you know, high culture, let's say. And so, you know, they're working, they're putting stuff in a truck. I think for my father, I boxed everything up. I had done all that work. It was a miserable few days, let me tell you. But so they loading it up, and they're listening to the radio and like gangster rap. And now, you know, the nice guys, they did a great job, but that gives you an impression, right? When people are, you know, they're not dressed up or anything, they're wearing clothes anybody, well, I certainly would wear when moving people. And, the music they're listening to, you know, tells you a little bit about how to interact with them. It gives you an impression. Now the same company moving my grandmother, who lived in a different town, for my grandmother, we hired them to do the packing too. So I don't know if they send a more careful crew to do that. It's not just putting boxes on a truck. It's actually wrapping stuff, fragile stuff, and putting it neatly on a truck. So that crew came in, same sort of guys. And one of them had his music going, and I stopped and was listening, and I thought, wait a second, that's K-Love. That's Christian rock. And so we struck up a conversation about the what call letters, I mean, what number on a dial it was up here versus down there out of New Bedford up here. And, you know, some of the songs. But, you know, that gives you a different perspective on somebody when they're listening to Christian rock as they work and as they pack up your stuff. It just does. You know, maybe it's not entirely fair, but it's not unfair entirely either. So in that regard, let me say that we all know that WBRU is an institution. I've been here long enough and was young enough when I moved here that I listened to it periodically for the alternative rock. But I do have to say, generally, I like the idea of a Christian resurgence in radio for a whole lot of reasons. I mean, it's not only because there are times when I listen to radio in my car, and if I'm happen to be listening to K-Love out of New Bedford, and I get as far as Providence, the signal fades, and so that'll be nice to be able to just switch the stations and still get it. But you know, it's different. You create a different society when people are driving around listening to worship music versus driving around listening to music that is almost the, at times, it's almost the inverse, almost satanic, often violent, cynical. You create a different kind of society. Now, we should have variety, that's for sure. But I'm just saying that I kind of like the idea that the up-and-coming culture in Rhode Island is, in some regards, possibly Christian. Now, of course, this could be an indication of changing markets. I mean, the BRU-type audiences are probably younger. They're moving away from the airwaves for the most part, probably listening to, you know, various music services on their phones rather than tuning into the radio where you need to be over the air. But, you know, I mean, maybe I'm reading it too much into it, but I can't help but feel like it's a good thing. But at the same time, you can't help but feel that BRU, the sale of BRU is being presented almost with like a tone of controversy. And I don't know that I've seen that in the past when, I mean, recently another radio station around here, I believe a few months ago, changed hands, and there was nothing like this controversy. Now, maybe it's because news reporters in the area have a particular affection for this particular radio station. I don't know. But you do that get the impression that part of it is that it's Christian rock, and that creates the sense of, whoa, that's just not appropriate to replace BRU with Christian rock. And, you know, largely for the same reason that I have a positive feeling about it, others have a negative feeling about it. But, you know, it kind of feels like Radio Free Europe around here, right? After all, college is an insulated environment, and you can imagine some Christian Brown student who tuning into 95.5 now, and rather than the cynical, aggressive alternative music, finds Christian rock, and it might be familiar to home, or it might just be a reminder that, you know, there's a moral life beyond the asylum gates, so to speak. I didn't grab the clip, but in one of part of my podcast listening this week, somebody opined that colleges now have reached the point where you drop off your children and it's like the schools are instantly trying to tear apart everything you've spent your entire parenthood bringing up your children to believe and to understand. And so colleges see it as their mission to tear that all down over their 4, 6, 8, 12 years or whatever it might be. So, you know, here's this beaming in from beyond the gates and over the walls, is this positive message with people offering prayers for each other across the country on a regular basis. And I can't help but feel that that's a good thing too. But the idea of this insulated environment brings to mind a podcast I haven't listened to before, but something about the title of this one, I think it was The Liberal Eclipse was the title of this episode. It's on ricochet.com, which I do visit frequently. But this one's the Harvard Lunch Club podcast. And I gather the two guys talking are graduated from Harvard and uniquely are conservative. Their names are Michael Stopa and Todd Feinberg. And Michael Stopa put something well. They were talking about the issue with Google firing somebody for disagreeing with their diversity policy. And Michael Stopa made an interesting point in that regard.
Last week we had Heather McDonald on our show, and she had written a piece just a while ago for the Wall Street Journal, And that piece suggested that whereas the left had fully, completely taken over the halls of academia, and we know that, they've been working on that for half a century, that invasion of academia, having been successfully accomplished, has now moved on to Google, and particularly the other Fortune 500 companies, where people have graduated from academia, imbibed, have drunk the Kool-Aid, and gone on, and they create the same sort of regimes within the corporate world that we're used to seeing we're used to seeing in academia.
Now, I think Stopa makes a little bit of an error in making this a broad threat to the future, because we forget. we can get caught up in the ideological back and forth, and we forget, you know, there's such a thing as reality. Now, I mentioned a few minutes ago that college is an insulated environment. Actively, for decades, the idea has been to, in some respects, to start trying out the real world and experimenting a little bit while becoming an adult out from under your parents' wing. But your parents are still there to bail you out often. If not your parents, you're still considered young. In our day and age, you're still considered a kid until you're 26, right? You're still on health insurance, your parents' health insurance by federal law. So college is insulated in that regard. They have a police force, but it's a real police force, but I mean, it has its own, partly because they want to treat the people there a little differently, because you're still growing up in effect. That can't go in the real world. The real world isn't insulated. I mean, progressives want to make it seem that way, and they can undermine our economy quite a bit trying to do it, but they can't succeed. But notice where this is most observable, at places like Google, where there's just money beyond imagining, right? So that's, you can kind of insulate yourself when you're in that world. And I've never researched the work environment at Google, but at least the cliches and the pictures, and there was a movie about it, I think, right? Where they try to make it seem like a insulated college campus kind of an environment. That can't happen for most people most of the time, particularly with the growing divisions we're seeing now as far as economic dispersion. So I don't think we have to worry about that, the college environment or the college sensibility going out into the whole real world very broadly. Of course, people can cause a lot of pain for them, well, experience a lot of pain themselves as they face down the real world, and cause a lot of pain for others trying to change the real world to be this padded room, but ultimately it'll fail. But I think as my liking the idea of Christian radio being beamed over the Brown campus suggests, I think it's also important for us not to cede the presentation of reality in large segments of society, not to just say, well, that's where they do these crazy things. I mean, we need to pull that in, especially, I mean, recently, it's just becoming increasingly clear that how our different perspectives almost affect the reality that we seem, that we see. We could live, it's like we can live in two different worlds. And as I've said before, the problem with accepting false realities is that you can be surprised when real reality asserts itself. And I bring this up because in a humorous way, Andrew Clavin, on his podcast, he made a humorous point when it came to President Obama and the Little Sisters of the Poor that I think gets to this question.
When was the last time Donald Trump did anything to get in the way of the practice of our religion, of the free expression of our religion, like Obama did when he sued the Little Sisters of the Poor? The Little Sisters of the Poor. I mean, how much of a villain do you have to, you have to twirl your mustache to go after the Little Sisters of the Poor to force them to pay for for contraception? I mean, it's like, when he did that, I was like, I thought, gee, if there were any media at all, if we had any honest media, they would be looking at the president of the United States saying, you are using the power of the government to go after the Little Sisters of the Poor. It's like, no, Mr. President, don't make us pay for contraception. Yes, you will pay for contraception, Little Sisters of the Poor. It will. You will pay or I'll tie you to the railroad track. But I mean, he got away with it because the press wouldn't do it.
There is no objective standard, in other words. There's just, you're a bad guy if you're against the left, and you're a good guy if you're for the left. There's no big government oppressing women. That's not an objective standard. You might think it is with all the war on women type talk, but it doesn't matter. It's entirely ideological. It's just like recently, and I wrote about this on theoceanstatecurrent.com, billionaire Tim Gill, who I guess founded Quark, which is desktop publishing software that I used to use a lot, and it was good software. It might still be. I've switched for other reasons, but so he's gay, billionaire guy, and he's behind a lot of the activism for gay marriage and so on in the past decade or so. His money is, anyway, and his organizing prowess, I guess. And he made a comment in Rolling Stone that, he's, now that they've got same-sex marriage, his goal is to punish the wicked. And, you know, he's joking around and stuff like that. But it's further evidence that the news media and others do not follow any kind of objective rule. Here's this super wealthy white guy who's talking about punishing the wicked by taking away, I would say, and objectively taking away rights to free association for a business to not participate in a same-sex wedding with their services. That is a right. You can say, well, you could call it a privilege, but that gets right back to the complication of what's a privilege and what's a right is often ideologically determined by the person speaking. But so there's no objective measure. I mean, with the Little Sisters of the Poor, you know, you can present charitable women as villains. That's fine in the eyes of the news media, provided they're Christian nuns. What other women who gather together to accomplish some admirable goal, taking care of people, would engender this sort of blasé attitude when big government comes in and passes a law to force them to do something that goes against what they believe? I mean, objectively, that's what's happening here. And similarly, I posted yesterday, I believe, on the legislation in Rhode Island banning conversion therapy, which is when people who don't want to have same-sex attractions or, I guess, transgender feelings nowadays, go to a therapist and try to work through those feelings. And I pointed out that a lot of the advocates, Representative Edith Ajello from Providence and Senator Donna Nesselbush from North Providence, Pawtucket, their attitude is that, well, you know, that these feelings of attraction are natural and unassailable. But, you know, if you step back and look at it objectively and break it into logical categories, you've got biology, which is pretty innate, right? Then you've got the same-sex attraction, and then maybe you have a feeling that your attraction should accompany your biology rather than your initial emotion. I'm not advocating one way or the other, right, with this. I'm just saying those are objective, and yet they'll throw out any notion that people have a right to disagree with government by banning this therapy. And that was, I think, Nesselbush's comment was something like, we need to send a message to people and their parents that this is your natural feeling, and you'll be happier when you live an authentic, honest life. Well, you're defining for them what part of this body, of traction or and moral feelings, what part of this is your authentic life? That's theocracy. There's no way to put it. But again, there's no objective standards. And it all seems to come down to advancing an ideology, advancing one's beliefs and trying to impose them on other people. Now, if I can take this back to Harvard Lunch Club and Michael Stopa again, it was just funny. I actually preferred much of what the other guy said, but Michael Stopa had a few better, you know, shining comments. But he provided in that same episode, he provided a great metaphor for a phenomenon that I've mentioned from time to time, and mm-hmm. I noticed it mostly. I bring it up with reference to my experience debating literature in college at URI, University of Rhode Island, and how you'd be having this conversation, and it was almost always me against the professor and anybody else who was talking, with a lot of other people kind of not wanting to get involved, I guess, or not feeling it had anything to do with that or whatever. But so I'd be holding my own, I think, pretty strongly, and maybe even had an advantage in the debate, pow, bada bing, bang, bang, boom. And I would say something, you know, whatever. Some word would come into the conversation. Like, I don't know. It's harder to see at night because it's darker, you know, something like that. And people in the class would throw up their arms, go, "Oh, darker, darker. You mean like black people see? It's racist." What? No. It was gone though. They were done. That gave them their pretense to dismiss me and move along. And so, I mentioned that kind of impression from time to time. And I thought this from Michael Stopa is a really good metaphor for that dynamic.
My metaphor for it is that when Trump said both sides, that the mainstream media or the left-wing media is like this champion halfback in football who's better than anyone else and who only needs the tiniest crease to manage to burst through into the open field and initiate an 80-yard run to the end zone. Those two words, right? Both sides. That's it. That's all they had, and yet they managed to turn that into an electrifying run down the field because they managed to get through there. And then once you're two steps into the secondary, all of a sudden the secondary is getting a little confused and they're running into each other. And then the next thing you know, you're at pay dirt. And
now, my only quibble here, and obviously the news media is very powerful, so they are able to turn these little things into giant scandals if they want to, or make giant scandals into seem like little things. My only quibble here is in the larger use of this metaphor, the people doing this aren't like a great athlete. They only think that they are. They think that they only need that small opening to insist that they've scored a touchdown. Now, I guess the difference is that the news media isn't scoring that touchdown. They're just powerful enough to be able to own the announcer. So the announcer will say, "They scored a touchdown." Now, whether the referees agree will take, you know, Americans to absorb all this and digest it and then vote and stop buying newspapers or whatever, which has been what's happening. So they just think they're that great athlete in essence. They think they only need that small opening and they win. It reminds me of actually a line that Andrew Lloyd Webber gave to Judas in his rock musical Jesus Christ Superstar, and that song is the introduction and exit music for this episode. Strange thing, mystifying. But in a scene in Jesus Christ Superstar, Judas is criticizing Jesus for associating with Mary Magdalene, and Judas says, "They only need a small excuse to put us all away." And that's really what it comes down to, is a little slip and you can be dismissed. and this is increasingly clear. And what's astonishing, though, is that some people don't see it, even, you know, some conservatives, smart conservatives. And that came up for me on Ricochet again, the GLOP podcast, GLOP being Jonah Goldberg, that's a G, Rob Long, L-O-P is John Podhoretz. And they talk about culture, but also a heavy dose of politics and political theory. And so John Podhoretz, well, they've all been pretty anti-Trump, Podhoretz especially. And in this episode, they were criticizing the president's comments related to Charlottesville. And Podhoretz had this peculiar thing to say.
Liberals use events like Charlottesville to say those who oppose affirmative action are no different from the Nazis who are marching.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So
right.
Rather than having a clean and pristine record on matters of racism so that you can then, when you are speaking on controversial matters involving race, you cannot so easily be tagged with the charge if you are contaminated by racism in your
right.
proximity.
Right.
Your argument that affirmative action is not just another form of racism is harder to make.
Pristine record? I mean, by whose measure? You know, that never works. They only need a small excuse to put us all away. The idea that you can build up a lifetime of goodwill. I mean, Jeff Sessions slammed as a racist, and far from it. If you look at his actual record and things he's actually done, John McCain has built up a career of being the mavericky Republican who's willing to do things that the Democrats and liberals want. It availed him nothing when he ran for president against Barack Obama. He was still slammed and had professional photographers for news organizations make photoshopping his pictures and making the lighting terrible so that he looked like a monster. Mitt Romney has a black grandson, if I recall that was the relation. But the mainstreamers mocked him for it. If anything, he's only in the good graces of the left now because he's opposed to the actual Republican president. It bought him nothing. There's a single difference in opinion with the left erases everything else. Sure, you know, maybe your own feelings, you feel like, well, I can say this about affirmative action because I have a pristine record. Maybe you're among your friends and family commentators, maybe among their circle, you know, the people on the GLOP podcast and the wider kind of National Review conservative groups. Maybe among them you have credibility. But you don't get away with it in the mainstream. You don't buy any. You are in that instant what they need you to be. There's no history. There's no what happened the day before yesterday. You know, there's no, another Ricochet podcast. Again, I didn't grab the clip, but cause I'm still listening to it actually. The one that's called the Ricochet podcast, Peter Robinson, I believe, or maybe it was James Lilex, was talking about how Wolf Blitzer on CNN was claiming that the Islamic terrorist who drove some cars into a crowd the other day in Barcelona was a copycat of the psycho who did the same thing at the Charlottesville. Peter Robinson, I think, called that a kind of insanity. It just, you cannot believe that unless history started this morning for you. And the same thing goes with all of the racial discussion, all of this discussion. You don't get to do that. You don't get a badge. You don't get a series of cards that you can then play and get the attention and get the respect of the left in the mainstream news media. Now, maybe once that was the case, and maybe the reason, maybe that it is no longer the case is partly why people are disengaging from that mainstream narrative and doing things, crazy things like electing Donald Trump to the presidency. But, you know, in this current context, my advice would be, you know, don't try to build up that pristine record. It's a loser because it's like building up money and then having the economy fall apart, or like building up a lot of Monopoly cash and then finding out that you're not playing Monopoly anymore. The rules have changed and your currency is no longer worth anything. That's exactly what that's like. It's not worth the effort. So and I think this is probably timeless. The best thing to do is to say what you believe as well and as clearly as you can and defend it. And if people reject it because they want to misunderstand it or distort what you're saying, you know, they're going to do that. But all you can do is have integrity in your own regard. Now, I was going to end it there, but as it happens, I have a couple books in my, I'll call it a studio, but it's actually a closet that's convenient and quiet. So I move my computer, my microphone in there to do these podcasts and to call on the radio. So if you ever hear while I'm doing this, or especially on the John DePietro show or something, if you hear something that sounds like clothes hangers rattling, well, that's because that's what it is. And I talk with my hands a lot. But anyway, I have books in here so that I can elevate my computer higher as I talk, and you know, I also have a lot of books I've inherited, and many of them I will never read, so it's like inheriting a bunch of, you know, empty boxes. Well, much better than that. But anyway, one of the great things about having books everywhere is sometimes just out of curiosity you'll pick one up and look in it, and that's what I did just before, just as I was setting up for this podcast. It's the second supplemented edition of the Dictionary of American Slang, compiled by Harold Wentworth and Stuart Berg Flexner. And if I look at the attribution pages, it looks like it is the 1975 edition of this. So thinking, wow, I need a Dictionary of American Slang dated to 1975 because, you know, that really will tell me how to talk in 2017 America. But you're randomly opening it up. I came to this, and it's actually one of the phrases, you know, in a dictionary, they give you the first word on the left page and the last word on the right page on any given spread. And one of the right page spreads on page 131 is a great, a term I think could be useful bringing back. So it's, and in the spirit of not having a pristine record, by the way, the term is, the slang from 1975 is crow-jimism, which obviously is Jim Crowism reversed, but it's, here's the definition, it's great stuff. A strong psychological attraction to Negroes, said in reference to whites, usually used to characterize a guilt attitude arising from deep-rooted Negro phobia, or the operations of a politician who courts Negro votes for personal gain. Think about that. I mean, obviously the term Negro is antiquated in our usage now. In fact, even Stephen King, I think in one of his Gunslinger books, has somebody time travels and just can't get straight that now calling African Americans or blacks or Negroes one thing or the other, what was an insult 20 years earlier is now what you have to say. It's the same thing with gay, I'm finding. Now it used to be you couldn't say that. Now you can and you have to. It's hard to keep up, which is kind of how the totalitarians force you to always be on guard and feel insecure. But how about that? I mean, basically, this is people who are actually racist, and they feel guilty about it. They know they're racist. They feel guilty about it. And so they have an overt, they make overt pleas to people who are minorities. I think that's a useful term to keep in mind going forward, crow-jimism. So that's it for this episode. I'll see you next week.